Welcome to this episode of the Think Wildlife podcast. Today, I interview Dr. Andrew Stain, who is the founder and director of Claws Conservancies. Throughout his career, Andrew has worked extensively on mitigating human-carnivore conflict around Africa. He has done various research projects in this field. Now at Claws Conservancy, they work extensively on lion, leopard and wolf conservation with the aim of fostering human-wildlife coexistence.
So welcome, Andrew. It's a pleasure to have you on to talk about claw conservancies.
Thank you so much for having me.
What was the idea behind claw conservancies?
So the idea behind claws was to work with communities to develop approaches that can help people and wildlife thrive together.
Throughout your career, you have researched human-carnivore conflict extensively across Africa. So could you just briefly talk about some of the research work you have done?
Sure. My first real project was in South Africa. A little over 20 years ago, I studied leopards on commercial farms in northern South Africa for about 5 months. Then I worked in Kenya in Laikipia at Impala Research Center, leading the Samburu Laikipia Wild Dog Project for my boss, Dr. Rosie Woodruff. There I got some experience working on lions as well under Dr. Lawrence Frank, and I was there for about a year. Then I started my PhD work on leopards and brown hyenas on commercial farms in north central Namibia. I was a visiting researcher with the Cheetah Conservation Fund, and I was there for 3 years. Then I did my postdoc in Botswana for the Botswana Predator Conservation Trust, which is now Wildland Trust. And I was the research coordinator for their research station near Maremi Game Reserve at the edge of the Okavango Delta. And there we focused on the large carnivore guild, so lions, leopards, cheetahs, spotted hyenas, and African wild dogs. And now I started my own program and organization called CLAWS, stands for Communities Living Among Wildlife Sustainably. And we're primarily focused on lions along the northern edge of the Okavango Delta, where there's heavy conflict coming from the delta into communal areas.
Pride and outpride. So why is lion conflict on the rise in this landscape?
Yes. So we started Pride in Our Prides in response to devastating poisoning events that were happening in 2013. So villagers were targeting lions in retaliation for very high levels of conflict. And in that single year, they killed about 50% of the lions within this landscape, between 25 and 30 lions. So I heard from colleagues that had learned about these poisoning events. They had found dead vultures, sometimes 30, 40, 60 dead vultures at a time. And they said, you know, somebody's got to do something. So they contacted me knowing that I had had some experience working on large carnivores in conflict areas. And that's what brought me out here in 2014. So we started essentially trying to address the poison issue, because not only was it targeting lions, but it was a major biodiversity crisis because of the vultures, hyenas, jackals, other animals that might feed on the poison carcass. And then also that poison can get into the water supply and affect a wide range of species. So the first thing that we tried to do was to try to individualize lions, because if people were using poison, it's an indiscriminate way of dealing with the issue. And they looked at all lions as a problem species. So we came in, we didn't want to prosecute people and get them arrested or figure out where the poison was coming from, because we knew it was way too easily accessible. So what we needed to do was help share information about lions in a compassionate way, so that people could make more focused, non-lethal decisions about how to manage their resources so that they weren't using poison at all. And so the first thing we did was we put satellite tracking collars on the lions, tried to put one per social group, either pride or coalition. And then we had villagers name those lions in their local language so that they had a personal connection to each individual animal that had a collar. And in turn, like, learn about the different prides. And through that, we would give regular updates to people in the villages so that they knew which lions were causing problems and which ones were not. So that if they used poison and they eradicated a whole pride that was not causing problems, then they actually may cause an issue where new individuals come to the area and then start causing conflicts. So understanding that there is a difference in behavior between individuals with between prides. From there, we developed with colleagues from the University of Siegen in Germany, a state-of-the-art real-time alert system. When lions approach villages within 3 kilometers, then anybody who signed up to receive alerts will receive the name of the lion and the distance of how far that lion is, so that they can take preventative action, whether it be gathering the cattle and putting them in a protected enclosure, lighting small fires at night, you know, to deter the lions from coming in. And so over the last 4 years, we've been able to disperse over 30,000 alerts. And we've been able to help people reduce conflict by this like real-time alert system that we've developed.
So what have been some challenges in implementing the
early alert system?
So some of the early challenges with the alert system were signing people up. At first, it took a little while to explain exactly how it would work and what would happen. Up till now, we currently have 250 people signed up to receive alerts. So it's going actually quite well in that regard. Another challenge is that we need to put collars on these animals in order for them to release alerts. So not only purchasing collars, you know, getting the funding to put them out, purchase the collars, pay a veterinarian, all that kind of thing. But also, we've had challenges with some of the collars that we purchased not working very well, or like there were malfunctions in the technology. So we've had to change collar companies. Now the collars that we purchase are working quite well. But really, the bottleneck of the program is the number of collars that we can get out. So right now we have 5 collars on different social groups of lions, but we really need to bump that up to about 13 working collars at a minimum. So in our office today, we have 7 collars that we plan to deploy next month. And hopefully that'll get us up to numbers that are going to be more effective and more comprehensive for the alert system. The other challenge is that lions are active at night. And so oftentimes these alerts will come, you know, maybe 2 in the morning. And if you receive an alert and it's dark at night and your cattle are out roaming around and you receive an alert, you may not be as motivated to get out of bed and start walking around in the dark. So what we've done is we've established a response team where one of our staff members takes a vehicle, looks at the app to determine exactly where the lion is. He'll pick up a volunteer from the village, and then he'll use a variety of deterrents, things like firecrackers or vuvuzelas or other noisemakers, to try to encourage lions to retreat, to go further back into the delta where they're not going to cause any conflict. And we've been doing that for about 6 months, and the results have been pretty good. We've seen on the collars that the lions will move between 7 and 9 kilometers away from the village within just a few hours. So we're going to be monitoring that over time to see if lions habituate to this treatment, whether certain individuals respond in different ways, And we're hoping that we can expand that response team to have more staff members, more vehicles, so that we can address the conflicts, especially in the high season, which is typically November, December, January, where most of the conflicts for the year occur.
As part of this project, why are you focusing on incorporating traditional practices to reduce conflict with lions?
Yeah, so for us, traditional practices are at the heart of any successful program. There's a lot of local indigenous knowledge that's available. Many of the solutions that we try to implement are based on information that people from the villages already know. And they may need a little bit of support or help with organization in order to really maximize their effort. So for example, we started the Lion Alert system, but we realized quickly that the biggest issue on this landscape is that there are thousands of cattle wandering around unattended. Many of the traditional herders no longer are out in the field. In fact, over the last generation or so, the young herd boys that were 10, 12 years old that used to go out with cattle, that used to defend their cattle against lions, hyenas, and other predators, boys of that age are now in school. And the adult men in the village look at the job of a herder as a low status position because it's the job of young children. Many of the owners of cattle don't want to pay anybody to do the job because traditionally they never had to. So what we've done is we've facilitated a series of herder training courses. We brought in people ages 20 to 80. And in these courses, we talked about eco-literacy, understanding how grass grows, how grazing that grass is actually good for it in many of these systems, because the grass evolved in systems with huge herds of buffalo and other bulk grazers. So we're talking to people about how to bring together communal herds that could be several hundred individuals to kind of mimic the movement and impact, the positive environmental impact that large herds of natural herbivores have on the system. Then we talked about basic veterinary health. So what are some of the diseases that occur? Not only foot and mouth disease, but we see cattle get eye infections certain times of the year. They may get certain injuries, skin conditions, like these kinds of things. And so we've given these herders training in basic veterinary medicine so they can vaccinate the cattle themselves. They can diagnose and treat wounds as they come. And then the last piece is, of course, conflict mitigation. So we've supplied people with mobile lion-proof enclosures that are made up of basically a sheet of canvas that blocks the view of lions into the enclosure and blocks the view of cattle out of the enclosure so that they don't actually try to attack. The lions don't try to attack and the cattle don't try to break out. So in these trainings, it was very interesting because many of the elders that were present would share their stories of moving cattle from one season to the other, where good water was in the dry season, where the best grazing was. And so we could use that traditional information to actually structure our planned grazing system. And in fact, we formed a communal grazing committee in each village where we work, elected by the village. And they're the ones that make all the decisions about which herders to hire, where to move the cattle, how do we use specific resources most effectively in order to have a beneficial program for everybody. And through all of this, we're actually in the process of certifying the herd as wildlife friendly. We have worked with government to build a mobile quarantine so that the cattle coming through our program are certified as free of disease, specifically foot and mouth disease. So it can be part of a larger market where cattle owners can earn between 25 and 40% more money when they sell their cattle for beef than they would otherwise. So it's really a holistic approach using technology of the alert system, but then using traditional knowledge and additional resources to provide greater market access for people that herd their cattle, protect them from predators, disease, improve the rangelands, and they sign agreements saying that they will not shoot lions to be part of the program. And in fact, they don't. They have almost no losses to predators at all once they're in the system. So there's really no need to persecute lions at the end of the day.
Another project Laws Conservancy is working on is the Leopards Without Borders project. Could you just talk about this project a bit?
Yeah, so Leopards Without Borders is something still in its early stages. My primary background as a field biologist is on leopards. That's what I did my PhD on. And, you know, I've worked on leopards in South Africa, Namibia, and Botswana. And so currently I am the lead assessor for the IUCN Red List update, status update for leopards. So I am collecting information for leopards throughout their range, not only Africa, but throughout the Middle East and Asia, to understand their current status and publish the Red List report. And we'll be submitting that soon. Hopefully it'll be published either the end of this year, early next year. So that's the primary work that our program, specifically me, is doing for leopards range wide.
And the last project, the third project which Claus is working on is the Scent of a Wolf project. So what is this about?
Yes, so much of my work earlier on was helping with scent marking research with the Wild and Trust program. So we were taking scent marks left by African wild dogs, transporting them from the Okavango Delta to the Thule Block in the eastern part of the country, and then setting up what are called bio boundaries or bio fences. So I wanted to apply that principle to wolves in the western parts of the United States. So I've been in contact with ranchers over the years and government officials in the state of Montana, trying to get that project off the ground, looking at ways of collecting scent marks from wolves and then using it to communicate the edge of a territory to actually keep wolves out of high conflict areas. So at this point, you know, I've taken several trips to Montana, spoken at conferences, connected closely with state wolf biologists. And so we're still in the process of looking for funding to get that program off the ground.
But now moving more towards the global scale for human carnivore conflict. So what have been some global trends in human carnivore conflict in recent times?
Well, some of the trends are not particularly looking good overall. I mean, as people expand, their footprint expands on the landscape. As that happens, areas around protected areas or historic range of various predators become smaller and smaller. And so people come into more contact with predators, thereby creating more conflict. So generally speaking, conflict has gone up. But I do think that there are examples of ways in which researchers and conservationists have been able to employ a variety of different kinds of approaches to try to reduce that conflict, bring about greater levels of coexistence, but then also provide structures that people can actually benefit, like what we're trying to do with our communal herding program, where people actually get a higher price for their beef when they pledge not to kill lions and they're bringing up their cattle in a wildlife-friendly way. So there are solutions out there, and it's just a matter of adapting them and scaling up across larger landscapes.
So obviously recently there's been a lot of talk about rewilding and bringing back large carnivores, especially in Europe, and obviously in India there's the tiger population has shot up. But with this, obviously human carnivore conflict has been on the rise. So how do you think that future rewilding projects can minimize potential human carnivore conflict?
So the idea of rewilding is really exciting. And depending on the species and the area, I think we're finding that people in many of the countries where these animals disappeared are actually wanting to see these animals return. Not everybody. And oftentimes there is sort of a conflict between people. Many of the people that are living on the landscapes where these animals are released may not be as excited about their return. But I do think that if the some of the key things that need to be addressed before animals can be released, of course, is dealing with the issues that cause the extinctions or extirpations to begin with, right? So doing a lot of work to talk to local people, find out what their sensitivities are, whether they do want these animals reintroduced or not. If they don't, what are ways in which we can work with them to try to improve the situation so that animals can be released? If there are spaces in protected areas or areas where the animals can be released, then I think there's a much higher likelihood of success. Also, I think there needs to be like a pretty consistent program for community engagement and outreach, just to make sure that the people near, around, or living on landscapes with these reintroduced animals have some buy-in, feel that they have some stake. The more they know about the particular animals, even the individuals that are being released, I think there's a better chance for success. And that's what we find with our program, where we have local people, not the researchers like me, but local people naming the animals, following along with their stories. It's a much higher likelihood of people building their tolerance when they know the individuals and feel more engaged.
So coming back to Claw, so what have been some of the biggest challenges you have faced in incorporating these projects across Africa and the Montana Wolf Project?
There are a number of challenges. I think when you work with communities, it's really exciting. You get a lot of great information, but a lot of times it takes time to implement. A lot of people have different opinions, different ideas of how to implement or how well they want to support it. Oftentimes, it just takes identifying a few people that are willing to work with you, people that are influential within that community that work with you. And then once you find those people and you start to build momentum within the program, then you start to see some changes, and you start to see people being more and more interested. And that's when the program expands. For example, when we started training people on the herding program, we went to three villages and only one of them were willing to try. And then we started, and people brought about 800 cattle to be in one large mega herd. And we didn't have enough experience and manpower to really handle it. So what happened was there was a drought year. There were some challenges with animal conditioning. Many people actually removed their cattle from the program, and we went from about 800 to 130. But we had a few people that were sticking with us. And from there, we actually were able to rebuild that herd. We got up to about 400. Then we started a second herd in Eretza village because more people wanted to be involved. And now we expanded. We built a third herd in a second village because people wanted to take advantage of the program. So I think getting these things off the ground initially is a real challenge. Getting buy-in from people, gaining their trust, making sure people know that you're not just there for one field season or a couple of years, but you're here for the long haul. getting government officials to be a part of it. We actually had the president of Botswana come out in January, and he donated a breeding bull to our herding program. And he's actually said he's planning to come next month and donate another few bulls to the program to build up the breeding stock. So once people start to see there's government buy-in, people in the community that they trust that have tried, and they're seeing success. We're consistent with our message, and we're here to stay. We're hiring local people. Then people start to change their minds and get involved. That's one big challenge in getting started. Another thing is just bringing together the resources to keep the program going. When I first started, we had a staff of two people. We were up to four people in 2019. Our budget was about $200,000. Now we have a team of 30 people, and our budget's about $500,000. And as we look at the wear and tear on our vehicles, we look at some of the equipment, we realize that we need to reinvest in certain things. About eight people from our staff are doing a week-long training course in leadership. So we're trying to invest in our team, but all of these things take resources. So actually, the goal of bringing in enough funding to provide the resources we need is a constant struggle. And we always find people that are aligned in their thinking and their mission and their values to come on board and contribute in different ways. So I'd say those are the big things: getting local buy-in, making sure people know that we're here to stay, but then also keeping up the resources necessary to keep it going.
How can individuals contribute to a clause work?
So there are a number of ways of contributing. We need good people that can provide different kinds of advice, whether it be on, accounting, marketing. We're putting together a scientific advisory board now. That's going to be helpful. We're developing a lot of partnerships with universities. We have a student, graduate student from Yale University coming out soon. PhD student from the University of Botswana is going to start working with us. So bringing together people that have the expertise, but then also, as I mentioned before, providing the resources we need to keep our program going. As we build our team, a lot of times the infrastructure of our organization as a whole needs to grow to meet the demand. And we see that there's a lot of opportunities out there that we'd love to be able to take advantage of if we had a little bit more manpower and the funds available to bring in people that can help support our growth. And I think once we do that, we'll see much bigger impact on our work. So the best way to do that would be to go to our website, clawsconservancy.org, and go to the donate page. And provide even small amounts help quite a bit because it all adds up. And we'll be able to see a pretty significant increase in our impact if we're able to get the resources to do so.
And my final question for you today is that what has been your greatest learning from your conservation career?
There's a few big lessons that I've learned, especially early on. Now, I'm from the United States, primarily working in Africa. When I came across, my primary interest was wildlife conservation. These animals are disappearing, and somebody needs to do something, and I want to come and learn and help and all of that. But what I quickly realized is that wildlife is only going to survive if people permit it to do so, right? In areas where people do not want to allow wildlife to persist, they disappear. And oftentimes that's related to people's perceptions of the issues. So I learned early on to work with people. if people felt secure in their own livelihoods, if they felt secure in their ability to persist on landscapes with leopards, lions, and other dangerous animals, and they were able to share that landscape, the animals will actually do fine. So with our herding program, for example, it was really important to me to make sure that people's cattle were safe. We spend more time talking about the safety and security of cattle than we do about lions, because we know that if cattle are secure, they're not being killed by lions, they're not dying from disease, then there's no reason for people in the village to kill lions, especially when they're getting a better price for their cattle for pledging not to kill lions. So it's, at the end of the day, it's all about people. And luckily for me, like, I really like people. I like spending time in the villages. I like speaking to people, learning about their challenges, some of the things that they've learned growing up in this environment. And so any solution to conservation has to be centered around people.
Thank you so much. That is my final question for today. It was a pleasure speaking to you about the various projects you're a part of, and I hope you can continue your great work.
Thanks so much. Thanks for the opportunity to speak to you and share what we do. Yeah, we love the opportunity to do that anytime we can. So I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Think Wildlife podcast. Do not forget to subscribe and share this podcast.